Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation that works. With the tech to stay ahead and the know-how to act. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver and this is the show that looks at business and politics from a wider perspective. Coming up on the show today, move over AI. Quantum computing may be the latest tech trend you really need to know about. There's a new sheriff in Canada. We profile Mark Carney and ask if he's the right man to take on Donald Trump. And staying in North America, we hear about a legal action against Greenpeace in North Dakota that might change the landscape of America. You can, of course, email the show at takingstock@newstalk.com. But now, Irish quantum computing company Equal One made waves earlier this week by announcing it had created the world's first silicon-based quantum server designed for data centers and high-performance computing. We've been hearing for months now about the possibilities and potential of quantum computing. We've obviously covered ad nauseum, some of our listeners would say, what's happening with AI, but quantum computing may be the actual longer and more persistent tech story when we get into the details of it. So we decided we talk today on Taking Stock to someone who knows a lot about this, about both the technology, but also what the business applications might be of it all long term. And that's John Gould, who's a professor of quantum physics at Trinity College Dublin. He's joining me here in studio. You're welcome along, John.
Thanks very much for having me.
Listen, we've been talking about AI. As I said, we're almost, our eyes are no longer open at some point at this stage because we talked about it. But quantum computing, for some people who are in technology, think it actually could be even more explosive. My understanding of it is, which is very basic, that's why you're here, is that it's a new form of computing, departing from traditional computing, that's going to effectively have more power behind it. Can you just help and flesh it out a bit more than just that?
Yeah, that's right. So like AI, the idea for quantum computing has been around for a while. Quantum mechanics itself, we're roughly in its 100-year anniversary at the moment. And of course, in physics, quantum mechanics is kind of a very fundamental theory that describes, you know, matter at its most extreme levels, ranging from atoms to molecules. And I guess what's happened over the last number of decades is that experimental physicists have been able to control and isolate quantum systems with increasing precision. And, you know, there was ideas put forward in the 80s and early 90s whereby, you know, if you wanted to do a new form of computation, one way is that you could exploit unique quantum features to sort of do logical encoding of information using quantum carriers as opposed to classical carriers of information. Just to give you an example, you know, the basics of classical computing, the wonderful technologies that exist here in the studio, in your smartphone, in your pocket, fundamentally boils down to the ability to manipulate strings of ones and zeros at increasing speeds. The big difference with quantum mechanics is that because of the unusual properties, we can exploit something called superposition, where the information carriers, which are the physical system used to encode information. So in a classical computer, that's transistors, etc.
So the chips, basically.
The chips,
yeah.
Exactly. They allow for the logical, sorry, the fundamental currency of quantum computation is the qubit, as opposed to the bit in classical computation. So 0 and 1 in classical computation. In quantum computation, that can be both 0 and 1 simultaneously. And then when you have many quantum bits together, they can also exhibit very exotic forms of correlation called entanglement, which can be exploited to do a new paradigm for computation, which in certain problems allow for an exponentially faster speed up.
So a lot of this is coming from the coding side, is it? I mean, the language that's used.
Yeah, I would say the fair way to put it is that there are certain computational problems whereby using a quantum computer will be advantageous, so big compute problems. And that's the reason why over the last, say, number of decades you've seen, or sorry, the last number of years, you've seen a large flow of venture capital into the private sector for quantum startups like Equal One you mentioned in your introduction, and all over the world in general. Also significant sort of interest from the multinational sector. I think McKinsey have recently predicted quantum computing to grow to a market size of $1 trillion by 2035. And the reason for that is the sort of the applications in certain certain applications. So, for example, in the pharmaceutical industry, quantum computers are expected to outperform classical simulations of certain drugs in optimization for finance, etc. And also, many of the applications are yet to remain undiscovered because we haven't yet sort of built what we call a fault-tolerant quantum computation, although there's been huge strides.
Sure. Now, obviously, people who are in the tech business, a lot of them learn different languages, different coding systems, and they can go out of fashion and you come obsolescent and somebody says, why did they ever do C++ or whatever? Now it's gone, right? I have talked to some technologists who said the only slight problem with quantum computing is that they've been learning everything about classical computing and now they're being told instead of driving a bike, you actually need to drive a car. So will this leave certain people marooned a little bit in terms of their skills, or is this something they can jump onto easily?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say so. So there's different ways to answer this, but I would say classical computing in the way that we see it now is going nowhere. So while quantum computers are expected to be very good in big compute problems, they're not very good at handling big data problems, but they generate a lot of data. So advances in quantum computing will go hand in hand with advances in standard sort of classical computing. When it comes to programming language, that's a very interesting question. So if people who are stuck in like standard story of computation would know that it was, you know, kind of computers as we know them now were very different in the 50s before the advent of the transistor. So you had computers that filled whole rooms, there was vacuum tubes, punch cards. You know, these were programmed in what's called assembly language. So you really had to understand the physical aspect of the electronical circuitry that you were working with. Nowadays, you can pick up a computer and you can program it. You know nothing in how physically the computer is working.
Yeah, it's like driving a car. You know how to drive the car, but you have no idea what's going on in the engine. That's someone else's problem.
100%. But the thing is that the way that quantum computing is right now, okay, and there's many startups also on the software side working on compilers, etc., the standard way of classical computing, it is that you really do need to know a lot about the device you're working on. And there's no front runner in the technology at the moment. So Equal One that you mentioned are a company that are interested in solid state design. IBM and Google use something called superconducting circuits. You have companies which use the internal states of atoms. So there's no real technology that's taken off like the transistor in classical computing. There hasn't been a moment like that in quantum computing yet. It could happen, but as of yet, it has not happened. And we have an array of different technologies.
Now, obviously, you've already mentioned pharma, you name checked, that they could do possibly something better there. It could crunch data and I presume you're talking about trial results and all
exactly.
that. It could look
reduce
at the efficacy.
Reduce the time scale.
So a drug could be got out quicker and so on, potentially. Is there any other applications that you would be excited about where it can do something that the current computers cannot?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, in the long run, looking down the line, as quantum computers continually improve and they develop something called error correction, which means they're able to internally correct for miniature errors that occur on the hardware, which happens also in classical computation. When you get to that level, there's also a big problem which is known to be more efficient on quantum computers, which is how to factorize into a very large number. And you might think, oh, that's a pretty boring application, right?
Oh, surely not.
No, but actually all of the emails in the world are encrypted by this sort of mathematical difficulty of factorizing a large number. So quantum computers are known to be able to do this problem much faster than classical computers. So they're a disruptive technology, which explains the large investment by big countries like
sure. So
obviously China
they can.
US.
So are you saying that they can crunch through data a lot quicker?
Yeah, in certain problems like search problems or in factorization problems, they're very good.
And so in practical terms, like so someone listening might say, you know, John is a very interesting fella and this all sounds right. But in terms of daily life, what will they be able to do for us that's going to make this leap forward? I know it's a difficult question, but is there certain areas you'd say, I'd say that, and obviously you're going to have the military part, I presume,
right,
as well.
Right. I think the best way to think about it is like in the early days of computing. You know, there's a famous quote by the founder of IBM, Watson, who said he thinks there's at least space in the world for 6 computers, right? So you would never have thought in the early days that would be the case. Now everybody has a computer wrapped around their wrist or in their pocket. So quantum computing at the moment looks like that at least the initial applications will be highly specialized into areas like you know, fertilizer design, drug design, stuff in sort of private sector. It might look like that maybe big companies would buy one to work on very specific problems, but it's difficult to extrapolate how this will affect us in our individual virtual lives, right? But by proxy, I mean, if you have new drugs, if you have new fertilizers, this will, you know, inevitably kind of, you know...
It will feed down.
Feed down into society, right?
Now, obviously, a lot of people listening will be saying AI is kind of front and center. We know about these large language models. People use ChatGPT, have the Chinese DeepSeek and all this sort of stuff. We're not here to discuss AI, but I'm presuming at some point... do the two of them end up linking up? So in other words, can you use this quantum computing to power up various AI platforms? Are they slightly different things?
Yeah, I mean, so there, again, there's two kind of aspects to it. On the one side, people are using the standard kind of large language models and classical AI on classical computers in conjunction with quantum systems to learn more about quantum systems. But also there is a whole research field of quantum artificial intelligence, which is kind of trying to find speed ups for certain tasks. Because, I mean, large language models and AI is very costly in computational power.
And so, a lot of energy required.
A lot of energy required. So people are working very hard at the moment to find ways that they can find like quantum computational algorithms, which make sort of these type of large language like modeling more effective.
So, I mean, one of the things you'd say is it's almost like having a horse and here's another, a more lean horse, a more of a thoroughbred horse.
Exactly. And again, I stress the fact that it'll be useful in certain computational problems. It won't be every problem. Quantum computation...
In terms of all the money soaking into this area, obviously it has huge potential. You've even highlighted one or two areas already that may be, you know, real commercial gold mines. What do you think is going to happen commercially? Like, where are the companies coming? Is this at the sort of R&D stage? Is this startup stage? Are the Microsofts and all those guys looking at it as well? Or is it very much...
That's the interesting thing. So we have something in Trinity called the Trinity Quantum Alliance, which is basically a physical space used where we collaborate with industry, but they're both startups and multinationals. So the big multinational companies, you know, Microsoft, Google, IBM are all trying to develop in-house technology, whereas all startups are emerging in different areas, like, for example, for different technological platforms, software, quantum compiling. And we see the sort of emergence of some of those companies in Ireland now, which is great to see. So
this company, Equal One, as I said, made an announcement during the week.
Yeah, I mean, and it's great, right? So I understand what they're trying to do there is trying to make qubits or quantum bits from silicon-based technology. And the big advantage or the big hope there is that unlike the IBMs and Google who've invested in superconducting technology, they don't require ultra-low temperatures in this big kind of dilution fridge. So you need to cool these things down in Google and IBM to really temperatures just a fraction above absolute zero. There's a huge engineering and energy overhead, whereas the silicon-based qubits that Equal One are investing in don't require this kind of cooling, and they can be automatically implemented in theory into a rack. Now, there's downside with every physical application with physical hardware implementation. In the case of solid state qubits that Equal One are working on, you know, there are some issues with respect to fabrication, their gate fidelities or the quality of the gates that they can implement are a bit lower.
One final question I need to ask you because we're out of time, unfortunately, is just the amount of energy that will be required to power up all these technologies. We know the data centers we've got a big issue with the grid here in Ireland, but outside that, globally, people worry about climate change, sustainability. Will say, okay, this is all great, this quantum computing stuff, but what does that mean in terms of energy and resource depletion of various things, from rare earths to metals to all sorts of... So where is that something that would concern you? Great on the science, but on the resources, not so good.
For sure. Look, I mean, data centers can't go away really because quantum computers still generate a lot of data. However, perhaps we can find more energy efficient ways to do the actual raw computation with them. So, I mean, there is a lot of research to be done in that respect. And actually, my own research is on the interface between energetics and quantum computation. And people are still, it's very much a topic of research.
It sounds impressive. I don't know what it's about, but it sounds interesting. And it sounds like you're very much on top of that. You're probably in the foothills of a very big technological advancement.
So you're
in a nice position to observe it and participate in it. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much. John Gould is a professor in quantum physics at Trinity College. Thank you for joining us and taking stock today and explaining what seems to us outsiders a tough and impenetrable subject, but you've gone and took some of the mystery away. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
This is Emmett Oliver here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we'll be heading to North Dakota. Welcome back to Taking Stock. My name is Emmett Oliver. Now, I want to take you to North Dakota, where a legal case is ongoing involving pipelines, free speech and US energy policy under the Trump administration. Jamie Smith, who's the US energy editor from FT.com, has been writing about this case and joins me now on Taking Stock. Jamie, you're very welcome.
Oh, hello, Emmett.
It's good to talk to you. Jamie, we all know that there's a certain position by the Trump administration. They're fairly in favour of fossil fuels. We had the whole drill, baby, drill, I suppose, ethos of the Trump administration. But this story from North Dakota is going a lot further than that. You've got objectors there, Greenpeace and other groups, who just by objecting have found themselves in court. Tell us more.
Yeah, it's a very interesting court case out in remote North Dakota. That's a state which has a lot of sort of oil and gas interests. And about 10 years ago, a company called Energy Transfer, which is run by Kelsey Warren, who's a big Trump donor, decided it wanted to build a pipeline across indigenous people's land. So it went ahead and tried to do this, and Greenpeace and one of the local indigenous tribes objected strongly. It became a huge issue, and there was thousands of people descended on this quite remote community to protest against the pipeline. Now, what's unfolded in the last couple of weeks in a courtroom in North Dakota is that Energy Transfer have sued Greenpeace for a huge amount of money, and on Wednesday, they got the verdict that they wanted. So they got a verdict saying that Greenpeace's actions in this protest had defamed the company. They were part of a conspiracy and they'd caused physical damage to this pipeline. And there was a $660 million damages award made against Greenpeace's US entities. Now, what Greenpeace says now is that that could well put their US operations out of business.
Wow.
So it's a big case.
And was the scale of the damages awarded, was that a huge surprise? I presume it was. Like, it sounds like an enormous, gargantuan figure.
It sure was. So punitive damages worth $400 million were agreed by the jury. At going into this trial, Greenpeace had warned that they faced a real struggle to survive in the US because they were figuring that they could face damages of up to $300 million, but the jury awarded much more. And Greenpeace has very much come out against the actual court process here. You know, it has said that this is really a test of freedom of speech in the US, and they've raised a lot of question marks over the process of the trial. It took place in a very pro-oil and gas area. They allege that there were pamphlets circulated across the whole community with very negative anti-Greenpeace information, you know, prior to the trial taking place. And they say that a lot of their objections to the trial, for example, that there was no live stream, it was, you know, you couldn't bring any phones or any recording devices into the case itself. You couldn't even bring a bag into the courtroom. They say that this was held in almost a secret manner, and they are disputing the judgment, and they are they're saying they're going to appeal to the North Dakota Supreme Court.
And what are they? You've obviously already mentioned defamation, but maybe you can flesh it out a bit more. What exactly are they being accused of doing, or where do they infringe the law? But what are the company claiming they have done to damage them?
Well, so Kelsey Warren, who previously said that activists should be removed from the gene pool at the biggest oil and gas conference in the US, you know, he's come out very strongly against Greenpeace, saying that they're part of this conspiracy to disrupt the company's operations. And he's argued that, you know, the comments that they made, that Greenpeace made, as well as other protesters, defamed the company and injured them in terms of their banks and their financial backers, you know? I mean, the company was basically alleging that this pipeline was, you know, an infringement on the indigenous rights in the neighborhood, that it was going across their lands, and that it would potentially impact their water supplies. There was also, you know, thousands of people came to protest, and there was some acts of vandalism and violence at these events almost a decade ago. Of course, Greenpeace says that actually they didn't organize these protests. It was actually the Standing Rock Sioux tribe that did organize the protests, that they admit, yeah, we made comments and protested, but they say there's nothing out of order with how they did. There was no physical damage or violence that their members took part in. And they're saying that really this goes to the heart of, you know, the right to protest and freedom of speech.
Well, that's what I was about, I was about to try and zone in on that. Obviously, the First Amendment traditionally over the centuries has guaranteed free speech. I presume when you came to the story first, you kind of thought, well, surely that's not going to fly. There's those very broad protections that are probably actually even stronger than you have in Europe in many respects. So it must have been a big surprise to you that that didn't hold water in the final outcome.
Well, I must say, one of our reporting team went down to North Dakota prior to the case and did a lot of sort of investigations. And it wasn't a surprise to us that the case went against Greenpeace, mainly because of the fact that in the US, you tend to get forum shopping where, you know, companies can pick and choose which courts they actually take cases and which judges even that will be hearing cases. And in this case, they can try and choose, you know, a court and a judge that might, you know, sort of favor their position. That's sort of a classic thing in the US. And this would be quite a conservative area. So it wasn't actually a big surprise that this judgment went against Greenpeace in my eyes. But certainly the size of the damages and the scale of these damages are really huge. So
do you think Greenpeace will go double or quits and appeal this? Or what are their legal avenues at this point? Can they get it into another forum, or are they very much stuck in the sand in North Dakota?
Well, certainly they can appeal it to the North Dakota Supreme Court. But during this case, they tried to appeal various aspects of the court case itself to that Supreme Court, but had been turned down because they were alleging that this case wasn't really going to be held in a fair manner. So they, you know, whether they get a positive decision from the Supreme Court in North Dakota, it's quite challenging. But interestingly, Greenpeace has taken a case in the Dutch courts and in the Netherlands. It's taken what's sort of called an anti-slap suit there, and it is a first test of EU rules on freedom of speech. So what we've been seeing in Europe is that, you know, certain companies, certain individuals have taken a lot of these sort of strategic lawsuits against people and organizations, and it could be on protests, you know, just try and stop protests or try and stop people speaking out on issues of public participation. And the EU passed a directive on this a couple of years ago, basically to try and give protection to organizations or people that are just, you know, following free speech. And so Greenpeace took this case in the Netherlands, and it's seeking for damages from Energy Transfer so that it can help cover the costs. You know, one of the underlying themes here is that, you know, the big oil companies are beginning to fight back a lot, and they are using the courts to, you know, push against protesters or people that are trying to sort of, criticize them. We had a big case recently here with ExxonMobil. It took a high-profile case in the US against activist investors who had asked it to change its climate rules, and it fought them in the court. And these were, you know, they're not rich organizations, these investors who had proposed at Exxon's AGM that this would be put up, that an issue would be put up for vote. So they're not rich organizations, but when Exxon brings you to court, Exxon has a lot of money to sort of push this at court level. So that was a classic case that went ahead recently, and actually the activist investors withdrew their proposal. And also just recently, Exxon sued the California Attorney General, Rob Bonta, because he had launched a lawsuit against Exxon in relation to its plastics recycling issues. So you're beginning to see the big oil companies using the courts quite a lot to sort of target, you know, critics and protests.
Sure, and obviously they've got a crucial supporter in the White House at the moment, Donald Trump. For I think even before running for the presidency in 2016, he was quite a big supporter of oil and gas, and you know, he said we need to be more energy independent, and we can see he's trying to get his hands apparently on Ukrainian nuclear power plants as we speak to you. He's known, his stance is known, the Republican mainstream party, obviously the Democrats are slightly different, although in some ways not that different. So can you just talk to us about this case and put it in that wider context of fossil fuels? You know, the US, obviously they've done well with these tar sands and so on. So can you just put us in the picture in terms of, is there any kind of, you know, in terms of popular political sentiment, is it very much the, you know, the fossil fuel industry is rebounding under Trump after maybe a less auspicious period under Biden and going back to Obama and so on? Or where are we in terms of just where debate is on whether we should be using fossil fuels at all, climate change, etc.? Just kind of fill us in on that picture.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things I think to say about Trump, right? And the Trump era, Trump 2.0, as they call it. So on the issue of protests, I mean, Trump himself has now turned the courts and the legal process against protesters here in the US. So you've had the deportation of pro-Palestinian protester who had a green card here in the US, even though that pro-Palestinian protester had spoken out against anti-Semitism. You know, the deportation issue is still going ahead. So that's been quite an interesting view. You know, the Trump administration is not going to tolerate protesters against, you know, issues that they hold dear. So that's one thing. And then on the, you know, Trump is obviously very close to the oil and gas industry. They provided tens of millions of dollars into his electoral campaign. They've been very supportive. And now, you know, they're going to be paid back in a sense, because initially, you know, in the first 2 months of this administration, you've seen so many actions to withdraw burdensome environmental rules, which the Biden administration had put on, you know, things like a methane fee. So if companies were found to have leaked a lot of methane into the atmosphere from their LNG facility, for example, you know, they would have faced a fee under these Biden rules. Well, they've been removed. And there were 31 actions last week by the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, it's there to protect Americans from, you know, toxic substances and things like that. But actually, the new administrator came in and said, well, actually, we want energy prices to go down. So we're going to remove 31 burdensome regulations.
And what regulations. I see, I suppose, hand in hand with that, as we see Trump administration championing the oil and gas industry, I'm presuming, but you'll be able to tell me more, is there, you know, a kind of deprioritization of the alternatives? I see a lot of headlines about renewables and wind in the US. So are they kind of on the back foot in terms of political power for the next few years as the fossil fuel companies set up encampments in the White House?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the first moves that Donald Trump did when he got in was he signed an executive order which basically said he was going to withdraw any permits from offshore wind. So he wouldn't issue any more permits for offshore wind. You know, that was all put on hold. So the whole offshore wind industry is now in a bit of a crisis, because if you haven't got up and running already or you're not half built, it's going to be impossible to actually do any new offshore wind farms. Even I think he also withdrew one permit from an onshore wind farm, and he also put all the other onshore wind industry on review. So they're doing a big review into that. So wind has been particularly affected. He really dislikes, actually, the turbines. He doesn't like them. I think there were some near.
He talks about them a lot, and he's worried about the birds.
He's worried about the birds, exactly. So wind's going to be, I think, under real pressure. I think underlying it all, there's something called the Inflation Reduction Act, which included all these incentives for clean energy. And he has said he wants to dismantle that. So some stuff's been put on hold already, but actually it's up to Congress on whether they take away all these incentives. So that's going to be an interesting debate over the next couple of months, because a lot of these clean energy projects actually went into Republican districts. So if you do remove the incentives, it'll slow or, you know, basically put on hold a lot of these projects. So The local Republican politicians have sort of a tricky situation there in that they want to show deference to Trump, but they also want to keep these jobs in their neighbourhoods. So be very interesting.
All right, well, a lot of our listeners will be greatly upset to hear all of this, but it'll keep you in gainful employment because there's a lot going on. Thank you for walking us through what's happening in North Dakota and the wider implications, of which there will be many. JB Smith, who's writing about energy for FT.com and the Financial Times, thank you very much for talking to us from the US. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Emmett.
This is Emmett Oliver here on Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, we'll hear about the new Canadian Prime Minister and whether he can spoil the Trump party. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Emmett Oliver. Now, he is the leader of a country that, depending on what President Trump feels at any given day, is in huge danger from tariffs and may even be the candidate to be the 51st state. He's also new to the job. That is Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney. He took the reins in the last week and has lost no time, really, in defending stoutly his country, despite the noises coming from south of the border. So who is Mark Carney, and is he equipped to survive the next few months and possibly even beyond that? I'm now delighted to be joined by Robert Fife, who is the Ottawa Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail. You're very welcome to Taking Stock, Robert.
Happy to do so.
Listen, we know a little bit about Mark Carney here because he was, of course, the governor of the Bank of England, and we can't see a lot of British news streaming into us here on the island of Ireland. But beyond that, can you just tell us how he has ascended to office? Because it seems to us to be a bit of a surprise in the sense that he's not in your parliament at all.
No, he isn't. He's the first prime minister who has never held elective office in Canadian history. And it's very unusual what's gone on here is that Justin Trudeau, who had been in power for almost a decade, had wanted to hang on desperately to political power, believing that he could beat the conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, even though for a year and a half, the conservatives had led the liberals by double-digit numbers. Finally, there was a palace coup. They forced him out, and Mr. Carney came in on a shining white horse as the central bank governor of Canada and the central bank governor of England. I'm the guy who can deal with Donald Trump and his tariffs. I'm the guy that can diversify Canadian trade to Europe and elsewhere. I'm the guy who can fix all of the problems that we are facing from a mercurial president in the White House. And it surprisingly has worked. He won 86% of the vote at the Liberal Leadership Convention, which is a stunning win, a landslide victory. And the Liberals, who were on death's doorstep, are now in neck and neck, and in some polls actually ahead of the Conservatives as we head into an election campaign that will be called on Sunday.
Now, we are all familiar with the Irish diaspora. Is there a Canadian diaspora? Because he's not the only one. Your deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, was a journalist in the UK, I think, for many years with the Financial Times. So you do have this thing about Canadians going overseas and then being brought back. Is that a trend over there in your politics?
Well, it has been. Actually, Michael Ignatieff, who was a brilliant academic who had lived in Britain for a long time and is now living in Vienna. But he had come. He was brought back to Canada as a savior as well, and he lost badly. So Mr. Carney has got all the great credentials. Certainly, he handled the 2008 global financial crisis here in Canada, and his as Bank of Canada governor, as a result of his excellent work in that regard, Britain came looking for him to handle the Bank of England. And of course, as you know, he went through the whole Brexit turmoil as the Bank of Canada governor. But he has no political experience. He is a rookie, a politician, and he has had some moments with the Canadian press because he does not like to get tough questions. He's used to a very compliant financial press that looks up to central bankers. But as you know, political reporters are a different breed.
You're being very diplomatic when you describe them like that. The other thing I was going to ask you about is there obviously was other candidates. Was there a bit of a dearth of quality in the bench for the Liberal Party? Or is he just being chosen because, come at the hour, come at the man, he has that financial background? What do you think swayed it for him critically?
No, they had a lot of good candidates who could have run. Ms. Freeland, obviously, was a former finance minister, former defense minister, or sorry, a former deputy prime minister. And there were a lot of other well-regarded cabinet ministers, such as Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly, the Industry Minister Francois Champagne. All of these people were looking at running, but basically everybody realized that this the Trudeau government was so unpopular that they needed a somebody from outside and somebody with the credentials to be able to deal with Donald Trump. The one thing about the Liberal Party you should know about, it's the most successful political party in the Western world. It has won more elections in Canada than any other political party. And that's because they don't care about principles. They care about political power.
Now, just remind us once again of why Justin Trudeau is leaving, because there was even reports a few weeks ago that he was not leaving at all because he gave some well-received speeches against Donald Trump. So is he just going because he's just run out of support? Is he just not popular anymore? They need a new voice, a new face. Why exactly is he going?
Well, this won't come to any surprise for people in Ireland. You know, if you've been in power for 10 years, people get pretty fed up with you. And his solution to every problem was to spend money. So we have a very, very big deficit. And basically, the country wanted to see the end of him. And he thought he could hang on. And one of the things that he was going to try to do was going to move Chrystia Freeland out as finance minister and bring in Mark Carney. Mark Carney got cold feet. Basically, why should I come in and try to save Mr. Trudeau's butt? And Ms. Freeland, when she got wind of this, she resigned on the day she was supposed to give an economic update to the Canadian Parliament. And that led to a mass movement within the Liberal Party to push him out. And he finally left on January the 6th. So that's what happened with Mr. Trudeau. He's now gone off into the sunset. And I'm sure you'll see him in Ireland, around Europe, gallivanting. And but his political days are over.
I'm getting a distinct impression you're not enamoured with the Liberal Party.
I don't have anything nice to say about Pierre Poilievre.
Oh, well, that's good. We'll get on to him in a second. So there's an election in October. Is in some ways then Donald Trump the biggest asset for Mark Carney, because this tariff war, it's likely to sort of, maybe not be completely disposed of, but it's likely to limp on at least to later this year.
No. There will not be an election in October. Mr. Carney is going to go to the Governor General and call an election campaign, likely for April.
Okay, 20th. So a lot earlier, right? Okay, originally it had been scheduled to be held in October.
The reason for this is that the Liberal momentum has gone up. They've jumped 20 points. And they're neck and neck or slightly ahead of the Conservatives. So they're calling an election when they can before things go bad for Mr. Carney. So or could go bad for Mr. Carney. So,
So does he need to get himself into a constituency, or can he continue to just operate ex-parliament under your system?
He has to run for a seat in parliament.
Right. But presumably that won't be a problem.
No, it won't be a problem. They'll find a very nice, safe seat for him to run.
Right. Okay. It's just so alien to us that you could not be in Parliament and be leading the whole country is strange to us. But
well, it would have been very strange. Parliament was supposed to come back on March 24th, and he would have had to sit in the visitors gallery to watch question period. So, but besides that, it didn't matter anyway, because we have a minority Liberal government right now, and the opposition parties would have defeated him at the first opportunity. So why get defeated? Why not do it on your own terms?
Now, obviously, the other party you mentioned is the Conservatives. They've been in opposition for quite a while. They were sort of tacking towards a sort of a Trumpian vision a few months ago. They seem to have pulled their horns in on that front and have been saying some comments that are less pleasant about him. So where are they situated in terms of all this tariff war and relations with the United States?
Well, it's a good question, because they thought they had a juggernaut that were going to win a massive majority government, and they'd been counting the plush offices that they hoped to move into. And now along comes Mark Carney, and the whole thing has changed, and the Conservative leader is in a real fight for his life right now. And it's been difficult for him, because a good chunk of the Conservative Party are like Trump. They And he's realized, and he's also spent the last year and a half telling the whole country that Canada is broken. But there's been such a massive surge in Canadian patriotism that he's had to abandon the whole Canada is broken line, and now it's Canada is first. But he has been speaking out on Donald Trump, and Donald Trump gave him a really nice gift this week, because Donald Trump said, I'd rather the Liberals win rather than that conservative fellow who hasn't been nice to me.
Right.
And Mr. Polyev was doing a jig, an Irish jig over that one. He said, see, the Liberals are pushovers. Donald Trump wants them. But with me, I'll be the tough guy to take them on.
So our voters, obviously tariffs are front and center, but is there a certain sense that, look, you know, this trade dispute might straighten out eventually and we probably should talk about one or two other issues? Or is this just the tariff election and virtually nothing else is getting oxygen?
Well, look, it is largely going to be an election over tariffs, but it's not just tariffs. Trump keeps saying he wants to annex Canada. So this is been an outrage to, obviously, Canadians. And, you know, April the 2nd comes along and he's going to hit the whole world with tariffs, including Ireland and the UK and everywhere else. At the end of the day, although it is Trump tariffs that are going to be largely the ballot box question, by the end of the campaign, it could be the cost of living and inflation, and who can best deal with the cost of living? Because I don't think these tariffs are going to go away anytime soon, even though it might cause a global recession and cause job losses in the United States. The president seems hell-bent on his tariff strategy, and he surrounded himself with a lot of sycophants who will tell him what he wants to hear.
Now, I haven't looked at the Canadian economy in a good few years, but my memory of it was you had a pretty good balance sheet. You had reasonably low debt compared to other countries, some of them close to us here in Ireland. So how long could the Canadian economy sustain a trade war with Trump? Obviously, they want to get it solved. They want to come to some kind of deal, but that may not be possible for quite a while, at least until maybe the midterm elections in the US next year. But how much pain can the Canadian economy sustain? What kind of condition is it in?
Well, look, 80% of our goods flow to the United States. So if Trump hits us with 25% tariffs on most Canadian goods, we're going to go into a recession. And there are going to be plant closures. Already people are losing their jobs. And Trump has imposed a 25% tariffs on Canadian steel and Canadian aluminum, even though we provide the U.S. with 60% of their aluminum. And this has already led to job losses. So we will be into a recession. And that's part of the reason is who's the most capable person in trying to help strengthen the Canadian economy and diversify trade. And, you know, we've got a whole lot of things that we've sat on our butts about, and now we now know we have to deal with it. We have 12 provinces, for example. We have to take down our own interprovincial trade barriers. Most of our oil and natural gas goes to the United States. They don't get world price, so we need to build pipelines and get our gas and oil to Asia and Europe. So we have a lost decade here because Mr. Trudeau was an environmentalist, and he was not a big believer in getting our natural resources to global markets. So we have a big catch up here.
I suppose my question is more like you can at least offset some of what's going to happen because you are in a reasonable good position. You know, your debt is low. For example, you could subsidize for a period some of the companies affected, right? And slightly put a comfort blanket around them.
Yes, the government is going to do that, and they're going to provide employment insurance for workers and make it more flexible. But it's, you know, we don't have an endless supply of money. 80% of your goods go to the United States. So it's going to have a big impact.
Like, you're not going to be able to diversify in such a short period. I see Mark Carney meeting the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer talking about trade links, but all of that is long term, presumably.
Well, no, we've been very close to a trade deal with the UK. I think we're having a fight over cheese. but hopefully we can resolve that issue. We do have a trade agreement with the Europeans, and we're part of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. But the problem is that Canadian businesses have been far too lazy in trying to go to global markets for the obvious reason that it's simpler to ship your goods or buy your goods from the United States or ship goods to the United States. We speak the same language. It's just across the border. We have two rail lines that go there. We have lots of highways. So it's a lot easier. Now it's going to be tough.
You're going to have a bit of a disadvantage. You know, it's easier, as you say, to trade with a country contiguous to you. So you're going to have to reinvent the wheel a little bit in trade terms.
Absolutely, we're going to have to do that, and it's going to be a hard slog. It's not going to happen overnight.
Now, what are the criticisms of Carney getting this job done, arriving at a deal of some description down the line, is that, you know, he doesn't have a whole lot of charisma. Having said that, some people in the financial area, which you did mention already, do see it slightly different. Some people say he has a steadying hand, that he combines, you know, that kind of a crisis manager, firefighter type thing. Other people say he's got a charisma deficit. Just describe the guy personally. You know, we know he's got the traditional Canadian background, even lots of photographs of him in his ice hockey gear and all the rest of it. But just describe him personally, whether you think he's personally equipped to kind of be a success.
He's a jogger. He can be very charming when he wants to be. But he doesn't suffer fools gladly, and he doesn't like to be questioned at least by us. He shows a bit of arrogance, and he certainly doesn't feel that he needs to be questioned. For example, we want to know how much money he's supposed to have filed conflict of interest disclosures, and he hasn't showed it to people. And so he was asked this week by reporters, why won't you tell us what potential conflicts you have? And he told a female journalist, you've got to look inside yourself. In other words, don't ask me these kind of questions. It backfired on him. It hurt himself. It hurt him with the public. So, but that's also part of the thing, is that he's a rookie. He's not used to dealing with in the public limelight as a politician. And he's used to being in the public light as a central banker, where there's a great deal of respect given to them.
Yeah, I would agree. They're sort of seen as maybe untouchable, maybe too often as well. Listen, we'd have to leave it there. Thanks for that account of him, both personally and professionally. Robert Fife is Ottawa Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail. Thank you for joining us on Taking Stock.
Happy to do so. Bye.
And that's it for this week's edition of Taking Stock. This was Emmett Oliver. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday morning on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you for listening, and please enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Empowering your business with deep industry expertise and tech-powered innovation. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.